content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service Studio. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be exploring your legal rights to help you gain equal access and full participation in our community. We hope to help you achieve your goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies, as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on laws supporting independent living. Today's episode, we have a special guest, Kyle Steele. Kyle, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Thank you for having me on the program. I'm excited to be here.
We're so glad to have you. Kyle is the head of the labor and employment section at Wyrick Robbins, and he's going to be speaking with us today about a very topical matter, something in the news, LGBTQ rights, something a little bit different for our program, but very timely, and glad to have you to address this for us, Kyle. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, Kyle, where you're from, your legal background, et cetera.
Yes. Well, I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, and went to UNC for college and law school. And I started my career actually as a colleague of Joe's, and he was a mentor for me and in the same employment practice group for many years until I changed firms and came to Wyrick Robbins, where I've been for about 5 years now. And I head up our employment practice group, and we regularly help employers and employees navigate the complex waters that are the employment laws of the United States and state of North Carolina. So it keeps me busy, it keeps me out of trouble, and it's something I enjoy quite a bit.
Well, we're glad to have a Tar Heel with us, a double dipper at UNC, and whose professional trajectory has always been on the rise. And take the opportunity to make a pitch for Wyrick Robbins and your labor and employment section, Kyle. Tell us a little bit more about all of the range of issues that you all take up.
Yes, certainly. Well, I would say that the work that we do at Wyrick Robbins and the employment practice group really goes into three buckets. You know, the first area that we really focus on is the beginning of the employment relationship. And we help primarily companies draft employment agreements and non-competition agreements and employment policies, everything that an employer would need for the start of the employer-employee relationship. The second phase that I think we really help employers with regularly is a consulting phase. You know, there are, as your listeners are well aware, having listened to this program, there are many obligations that employers must comply with to comply with the law. And oftentimes we have employers with questions. They want to do the right things. They want to make sure that they appropriately handle a request under the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Family Medical Leave Act or any of the other various employment laws at play. And so we provide counsel to those companies and individuals to ensure that they are doing things appropriately. And then I would say the last phase of things that we help with is litigation matters. If a company receives an inquiry from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission about a discrimination issue, from the Department of Labor about a wage and hour issue, or if there's a lawsuit filed in federal court or state court, we will assist that company in defending itself and in, you know, if there is an issue that needs to be addressed in negotiating an appropriate resolution.
So the LGBTQ issue that you're going to take up today, Let's just kind of go back in time to even before you were practicing, but it was not an issue. I mean, you could not say that was a protected characteristic, trait, or condition. And my goodness, how things have changed. So let's pick it up. It used to be one way, and now it's another. That was then, this is now. Tell us about the now aspect of LGBTQ issues, Kyle, and then work us into the case that you've been not working on, but looking at.
Yes. So as you mentioned, the law has changed quite a bit, and the Supreme Court case that I'm going to address in a moment really gave some clarity to folks in the employment law world on this topic. Before that, there was considerable discord among the various circuit courts. So those are the lower courts directly below the Supreme Court and the federal court system, with some courts saying that sexual orientation or transgender status may not have protection under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Now, as a reminder to the listeners, Title VII is the law passed in 1964 that protects employees from differential treatment on the basis of their race, their sex, their religion, their national origin, etc. And as you mentioned, in 1964, when this law was passed, certainly sexual orientation was not something that was being considered by the legislators in Congress at that time as something they wanted included as a protection there. And so the courts, the circuit courts, who in recent years have found that a protection against sex discrimination under Title VII does not include a protection against discrimination on sexual orientation, have oftentimes looked to the legislative history and found that Congress did not intend to protect against this sort of discrimination. And so, therefore, it was not included in Title VII. If Congress wanted to change that, they certainly had the means to do so by amending Title VII or passing a new law. And to that issue, and this is part of the court decisions, there often were bills in Congress, abbreviation was ENDA, ENDA, that would amend Title VII to make it explicit that sexual orientation was among the areas or protected characteristics included in Title VII. And so many courts look to the fact that Congress itself felt like it needed to pass a law to amend Title VII or to modify Title VII as a reason that sexual orientation was not included in the protections that Title VII otherwise would afford. Other circuit courts relied on developments under Title VII to come to a different conclusion. And those courts would say, well, Title VII not only protects you, for the protected characteristics of race and sex and so on, but it also protects the employees from stereotypes that are based on how you should be if you are a member of a certain sex or a certain race, or any of the other protected characteristics. And there was a very famous Supreme Court case in the 1980s. Where a woman was denied a partnership role at a big accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and in her performance evaluations, the managing partners or the people reviewing her said to her, "Well, you're not feminine enough. You're gruff. You're stern. You don't act in the way that we feel like a woman should act. And so therefore we don't think you should be a partner here." Some of the same characteristics that this woman was being, negatively reviewed for were positive characteristics in her male peers. You know, they're aggressive, they're take charge, etc. And so she sued the company, and the Supreme Court ultimately ruled that that was the protection against sexual stereotypes. How you should act as a woman in the workplace was prohibited under Title VII and something that this woman was protected against. So the courts in recent years who have said that sexual orientation was protected as a form of, sexual orientation discrimination was prohibited as a form of sex discrimination, have looked to that body of case law and said, well, if I'm a male employee and I'm terminated or disciplined or otherwise negatively impacted at work because of my sexual orientation, that's based on a sex stereotype. The stereotype being that men should be in heterosexual relationships with women. The stereotype, this particular employee is in a homosexual relationship, and so the employer is putting a stereotype upon that person and disciplining them for that reason. So there was a circuit split among the many circuits that of the federal courts, differing opinions. And when that happens, oftentimes the United States Supreme Court, which is the most senior federal court in the land, does take up that sort of case in order to make the law of the land consistent for all of the United States. Before going into the actual meat of the Supreme Court decision from last June, however, I think there are two other things that I want to mention just briefly. One is that the federal laws were not changing on sexual orientation. As I mentioned, there were several attempts to amend Title VII to include sexual orientation. But they ultimately all failed. Many state legislatures around the country passed their own laws protecting sexual orientation. And so that was one of the things just culturally that was happening, where state law was varying from federal law, and certainly states can put their own requirements with regard to these issues into place. But it was a challenge for employers, because if you operate in 20 different states, for instance, you may have to protect or consider these issues in half of them and not in the other half. So that's certainly something that was at play at this time. And then, of course, in 2015, so just about 6 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States did have the decision about homosexual marriage, gay marriage, and finding that to be protected in some form under the Constitution. That's outside the scope of really my expertise, but it is a sign of some of the opinions on that issue from the justices who make the decision on this one. So does that cover the lay of the land, Joe, prior to the Supreme Court case?
That's very good. There's a lot of sociology baked into the law, isn't there?
Yes, I would say so. And it's certainly not made in a vacuum, but I do think that the justices at the same time are applying the law to the best of their abilities as well. So I will go into the decision a little bit from the Supreme Court. The case, if any of your listeners are interested, was called Bostock versus Clayton County. And actually, the Supreme Court had three decisions from lower court that were all very similar in nature. And so they consolidated them and reviewed all three of the cases at the same time because they were very similar. And the plaintiff whose name, the case adopted, Bostock, was an employee in Georgia, and he was terminated after expressing interest in playing in a gay softball league. And the if you go look at the case, the reason for the termination was pretty stark, that, you know, he was interested in being in this gay softball league. It did not, according to the employer, conform to their values. And so it was pretty stark that that was the basis for the decision to end the employment relationship. Oftentimes in reviewing cases, you know, there's multiple reasons. So this was a pretty clear one for the Supreme Court to review as to what the nature of the termination decision was. Ultimately, the Supreme Court made a 6-3 decision, saying that discrimination on the basis of an employee's sexual orientation or gender identity, because one of the plaintiffs was a transgendered employee, if an employer discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, such discrimination is necessarily, quote unquote, because of sex, and that would be prohibited under Title VII. Interestingly, the majority opinion was written by Neil Gorsuch, who was, I believe, the most recent nominee to the Supreme Court at the time of the decision. He was nominated on January 31st, 2017, affirmed April of 2017. You know, based on that time frame, he was a President Trump nominee and, you know, considered to be conservative. And so some observers of the court at the time were surprised that Justice Gorsuch was the author of this opinion. But it was a pretty clear decision that sexual orientation, if that is the only basis for an employer's decision to terminate, that would be prohibited by Title VII. Other courts, lower courts, have now interpreted some of the issues in this Bostock case. And I will say that the Supreme Court did leave open certain issues to be decided at a later date.
So, Kyle, how much turnover has there been in the Supreme Court since that 6-3 decision? If it was a baseball score, what would the doubleheader? What's the difference in the makeup of the Supreme Court now, as opposed to then?
Yes. Well, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a part of that decision in June of 2020. She passed away last fall and was replaced in office by Amy Coney Barrett. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a nominee of President Clinton, a Democratic president, known to be a very liberal part of the Supreme Court. And Judge Barrett is obviously, you know, essentially brand new, but known to have had a conservative approach to the law in her prior judicial experience and then in some of her professional writing as an academic. And she is also someone that is very focused on religious freedom issues, which is one of the open questions that perhaps Bostock left unresolved.
So, but if it was a 6-3 decision and Gorsuch was among the six, we wouldn't anticipate that just that one change in the makeup of the Supreme Court would have an effect on that. I guess that's a valid thing to say.
Yes, I think that's probably a fair assumption. I will say that that there is a non-employment related case that I understand to be going to the Supreme Court soon, and it may have already been heard, but the decision has not been rendered, that people are watching very closely because of the change in the court that you referenced.
Mm-hmm.
There is there's a lot of focus on the Supreme Court in weighing what they would call as religious freedom versus the LGBT community rights issues. And so one of the things that the Supreme Court mentioned in this decision was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a law passed by Congress under the visage of the First Amendment of the Constitution, which says, of course, among other things, that the United States will not establish a religion or infringe on the freedom of religion. And this law can create variances from other federal laws if it unnecessarily inappropriately burdens religion. And so the Supreme Court referenced this law, and this is one of the open questions that court observers are really trying to interpret and see how other courts and the Supreme Court itself will apply. But under this RFRA, if the federal government substantially burdens a person's exercise of religion, mm-hmm. and the government furthers a compelling interest, is not furthering a compelling government interest in doing so, and the government has not used the least restrictive method of imposing burden on the religious freedom, then it may be a basis for the law to be struck down or modified. And so the Supreme Court referenced that law in connection to Title VII, which of course is the backbone, frankly, of employment discrimination law in the United States. And so it would be a major development in the employment law world if Title VII were to be modified at all as a result of this RFRA process referenced, almost in dictum, meaning, kind of a casual remark from the court. But the court did at least, crack the door open for that to happen in the future.
Going back to your Bostock case, not only the makeup of the court not changing to the point that there could be a different opinion in such short order. One thing we never get to talk about on legal matters is something that was something we took up in law school, you and I, which was stare decisis. Is not apt. The court's not apt to reverse itself in short order like that.
Yes, that's exactly right. I believe the Latin, and don't quote me on this, but I believe the Latin means the decision stands.
I think that's right.
And so the concept, as Joe is referencing, is the courts apply what they have done in the past to inform their future decisions, and they are loath to contradict themselves outside, except for an extreme overriding issue. And particularly, as Joe references, having kind of whiplash just because of political changes on the court to make a contradictory decision so soon after a decision is rendered would be unusual. Because the Supreme Court justices obviously want to respect the institution itself, and having stare decisis gives legitimacy to the court. What we do find is justices will distinguish prior case law if they can, find exceptions if they can, and find a way to reconcile a future decision with the past. But I do think that is certainly a good point, Joe, that the court will want to make sure that any future decisions are consistent with what they've done in the Bostock case.
And isn't it reassuring that we can have this discussion, even though there's about 30 years between our law school educations? There are some things that the that remain a major part of the curriculum, and we can communicate across generations. That's
absolutely.
Well, you know, one thing that just a war story. You were there too late to, I think, to have Professor Pollitt teach you constitutional law, but you know, he was a great one for saying the Constitution means what the majority of the Supreme Court says it means at any given time. There is some fluidity there. And any other issues that you see on the horizon that we can just pick up in a minute or two?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I mentioned that one of the plaintiffs was a transgender employee, and it was clear from the Supreme Court that transgender discrimination is a form of sex discrimination under Title VII. The Supreme Court did say that its decision did not reach to shared bathrooms or locker rooms, which is an issue that both transgendered employees and employers are interested in. There have been some lower court decisions on transgender employees' use of bathrooms, which have, on the whole, found that the employee should be able to use the bathroom of his or her identified gender. The EEOC, which is the federal agency that enforces Title VII, including sex discrimination, has held that position since at least the Obama administration. The guidance on that issue was not available during the Trump administration, at least publicly available on the website of the EEOC, but I do not think that it was ever formally revoked. And now that there is a change in administration, I would expect the EEOC, particularly once some new commissioners are confirmed in relatively short order here, that would continue to be the official policy of the EEOC. But well, that is an issue that we are asked about from time to time.
Well, thank you, Kyle. We've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Thank you so much. That was very informative. To our listeners, please be sure to tune in next time on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m., rebroadcast Wednesday at 7 a.m. We hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about your legal rights. I'm Joe Austin, and thank you once again, Kyle Still, for joining us. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you for having me.
Content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. After its broadcast, you can find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please do call us, 919-832-5138. You can also reach us via email at info@ncreadingservice.org. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.